Thank you very much, Tanya. I thought you were winding up there to give the audience a very difficult question for me to answer, but you provided the answer. Thanks to you and to Macquarie Bank for their support of this function today, again. Thanks also to the ABE, the Business Economist, for your logistical support in this, the eighth of these annual fundraising events. And I want to acknowledge Professor Ian Hickey. I thought he spoke very well. I offered him my text to see if he'd like to get up and read it out to you. He declined, but I acknowledge him. Thanks for coming, and thanks for all that you do. Once again, my topic today is challenges for economic policy. I'm not very inventive with titles for talks. If you've been to these occasions before, you'll know that I've used that title several times due to lack of imagination. But it usually works because there's usually some set of challenges or other that we can talk about. The ones I want to talk about today are those involved with dealing with and then recovering from the financial crisis that enveloped Europe, the US, and briefly the whole world in late 2008. And I'm going to argue that policies were very effective, actually, in putting a floor under economic activity in financial systems, but fostering a strong recovery after that has proven to be much more difficult. And I think that's basically a function of the nature of the shock that we faced. We've learned in particular, again, I think, about what the limits are to what monetary policy in particular can achieve by itself. I want to be clear that my remarks are set in a global context. They contain no particular message for Australia. I realise that you will find one anyway, but you've been warned. So let me begin with some remarks on the crisis itself. I've lived through a number of economic and financial issues in my 30-plus years in the Reserve Bank. In just about every one of them that was of any significance, people have claimed that it was the worst thing since the 1930s. In fact, one of the earliest substantive pieces of research I was involved in at the RBA sought to bring some evidence to bear on the claim that the 1983 recession was getting to be as bad as the 1930s. Of course, it wasn't. It wasn't even close. And almost all such claims are exaggerated. But when those who lived through 2008 and 9 say that there was the potential for an outcome every bit as disastrous as the 1930s, I don't think that is an exaggeration. I recently had cause for another purpose to review some of the material that we prepared in September and October of 2008 about what was happening, and it's just, when you go back and read it, it is just stunning what an extraordinary couple of months they were. Virtually every day would bring news of major financial institutions in distress, markets gyrating wildly, maybe even closing altogether, rapid international spillovers, and public interventions on an unprecedented scale as governments everywhere sought to stabilise the situation. It was a global panic, in other words. And the accounts of some of the key decision makers in the major countries that have been published, I think if you read them, and Tim Geithner's one is the latest, but that there have been many others, they give you a sense of just how close to the edge these people thought the system came and how difficult the task was of preventing it from going over. One advantage that the current generation of policymakers have had, of course, was that although they had never lived through a 1930s-style episode, they had at least some understanding of what had happened back there, and they'd absorbed some of the lessons, some of the things to do and things to avoid once a crisis like that erupts. That was as a result of a large output of scholarship, including by one scholar who, as it turns out, happened to be chairman of the Fed at the critical moment this time around. Among those lessons, and this isn't an exhaustive list, but among them I would say are the following. Firstly, be prepared to add liquidity, if necessary a lot of it, to a system that's under stress. Secondly, Don't let bank failures and a massive credit crunch reinforce a contraction in economic activity that is almost certainly beginning already. Try to break that feedback loop if you can. Thirdly, be prepared to use macroeconomic policy aggressively and quickly. Fourth, so far as possible, maintain dialogue and cooperation between countries and keep markets open. And fifth, act in ways that promote confidence. Sound like you have a plan? Well, policymakers understood those lessons, and there were plenty of mistakes and misjudgments along the way, and there always will be. But by and large, those lessons informed the responses to the crisis. Liquidity in most jurisdictions was ample. Central banks were very generous and quite inventive, actually, in finding ways to supply it. A point that was made many times was that liquidity cannot solve a solvency crisis, a solvency problem, and that's quite true. But not adding liquidity to a stress situation won't do any good on the solvency side, and it will probably make things worse. Authorities in all jurisdictions understood the need to prevent the spiral of defaults of large financial institutions that would further add to already tightened credit conditions. In October 2008, in fact, the G7 finance ministers and governors more or less said explicitly that there would be no more failures of systemically important institutions. Countries were prepared to use guarantees and so on, and there was public injection of capital into banks where needed. Now, people will rightly worry and have rightly worried about moral hazard and perpetuating too big to fail and so on. And that's a very legitimate concern. It's a powerful reason for reform in the future. But it wasn't a basis of policy when you face imminent disaster. As for macroeconomic policy, well, just about every country adopted more expansionary settings. The major central banks and almost all smaller ones cut interest rates aggressively after the Lehman failure. Governments were advised by bodies like the IMF, very unusual this, to pursue fiscal expansion to the extent that they had so-called fiscal space. Most of them did, even in cases where space was rather limited. The spirit of international cooperation, which is so often honoured in the breach in normal times, was actually, at the critical moments, pretty good. An example of that is the swap lines that the Fed had with a number of other central banks, including ourselves. They went into place very quickly, and in excess of $500 billion US dollars worth of liquidity, dollar liquidity, went into the global system really over the space of just a few weeks. That was a good example of cooperation. Agreement on the broad contours of other elements of the responses at the height of the crisis was also found pretty quickly, really, all things considered. So at moments when the world needed to hear that the people in charge understood what was happening and had a plan, the G20 leaders sounded like they had one. And it sounded like it might just work. As well as stabilising the financial system, they committed to avoiding protectionism and eschewing competition via exchange rate depreciation and so on. As the leaders said in their September 2009 summit in Pittsburgh, and I quote, "It worked." The decline in global output and trade in the last quarter of 2008 was at a pace which rivaled the contraction of the 1930s. Had it gone on, we can be sure that tens of millions more people would today be unemployed, and that trillions of dollars more wealth would have been destroyed. But it didn't go on. It was arrested. And as a result, we talk about the Great Recession, but we don't talk about the Great Depression Mark II. These initial interventions achieved what they were supposed to. And we mightn't like the politics of it, the optics, the bailouts, the sense that some people who behaved irresponsibly got away with it, all the recriminations, the second-guessing after the event, and there's been a lot of that. But the alternative courses of actions were worse. And I think that should be accepted more or less by most reasonable people. So that's stabilising the crisis. But what about then the policies to get growth resuming? And that's what I want to talk about now. It's one thing to staunch the tide of bank failures by massive public intervention, but to help secure a recovery in the financial system and therefore in the economy, banks' balance sheets had to be fixed. There were genuine problems with asset quality. There was a liquidity problem, but there was also a genuine asset quality problem. And it did little good to pretend otherwise. There had to be an honest accounting of those problems, and until there was, counterparty risk aversion would continue because no one knew who to trust. An honest accounting of the assets meant that you had to own up to a shortage of capital on the liability side. There really had never been enough capital in a number of these entities for the sorts of risks they were running, and what capital there had been in many instances was reduced or gone. So that had to be fixed either by taking capital from the markets or from the government or both. And the stress tests conducted by the US authorities in 2009 were designed with that dual purpose in mind. They were effective in getting clarity over asset quality and in strengthening capital positions. That, as you know, has been a lot harder to achieve in Europe for various reasons that have to do with the inherent complexity of the European project. And so in Europe, this remains a work in progress. Nonetheless, the lesson still holds that fixing the balance sheets of the banks is a necessary condition for recovery. But while fixing the banks is a necessary condition, it's not a sufficient one. A sound financial system can accommodate growth by supplying the necessary credit. But a sound financial system alone isn't the originating force for growth, at least not the kind of sustainable and soundly based growth that we want. Macroeconomic policies, therefore, had a role as well. One of the difficulties, of course, here on the fiscal side has been that public debt burdens rose very sharply. That's partly a result of the cost of fiscal stimulus measures and bank recapitalisations in some cases, but it's mainly because of the depth of the downturn in economic activity. A financial crisis and a deep recession that invariably follows it can easily add 20 or 30 percentage points of GDP to the ratio of debt, and it did so in plenty of instances. Moreover, since it looks as though economic activity isn't going back to its pre-existing trend level anytime soon in many of these countries, that means public finances have been left, public revenues have been left on a lower track, and therefore public finances generally have been left in a fragile condition in a number of cases. The fact that some countries went into the episode having avoided serious efforts at fiscal consolidation for a long time, by which I mean 30 years, and hence already had large debt burdens, of course, only makes the problem worse. So fiscal policy hasn't had as much scope to continue supporting the recovery after its initial stimulus efforts as one might have hoped. And policymakers in a number of instances have felt that they had little choice but to move into consolidation mode rather early in the upswing. Now, there's a lot of debate about whether that was right or wrong, and whatever your view about that, and people can differ, but the fact is that's the way things have turned out. And that left monetary policy in the major countries and around the world trying to support demand. But, of course, monetary policy has had its own problems in doing this. The Fed and some other central banks quickly found themselves in a situation in which the short-term interest rate reached, for practical purposes, the zero lower bound. Now, as many of you, all of you probably would know, this has echoes of the so-called liquidity trap, something that we learned about as a textbook possibility when we were students, but something which seems to have become a real-life experience in a number of countries. That had, in fact, already been noticed for Japan by memorable paper by Paul Krugman as long ago as 1998. The liquidity trap was a hypothesis of Keynes, who contemplated the possibility of a world in which additional injections of money into the economy become ineffective at reducing interest rates further because people become basically content to just hold the extra cash. In the original specification, this was supposed to happen at some positive interest rate. Now, it turns out in the real world that the short-term rate really can go more or less to zero, but it can't realistically get much lower than that. That, of course, still left long rates. And in countries like the US or in Europe, those rates matter a great deal for borrowing behaviour. So the central banks didn't accept that the policy rate being zero meant that that was it. They felt they could ease further, enter so-called quantitative easing, or QE. Well, what is this thing, QE? Essentially, it's unsterilised intervention in asset markets by the central bank, which expands its own balance sheet, buying assets for cash. The market for long-term government debt, for agency securities, for some types of private paper, have all been affected by these activities in the US, in the UK, of course in Japan, over a much longer period. Similar interventions have occurred in Europe, though the motivating narrative is different there, given the particular circumstances of the single currency arrangements. Well, by definition, since QE is unsterilised, it results in a rise in settlement balances, or what the academics used to call high-powered money, at the central bank. Sometimes people point to that fact as indicating a failure of the policy, and we hear that the money's just sitting at the central bank, the banks haven't lent it out. That's actually not a very good understanding of what's happened. The fact is that those extra settlement balances have to remain in the system, however hard the market tries to lend them out, until the central bank decides to take them out again. That's actually how central banking works. In fact, QE works mainly not by some credit multiplier process, but by pushing down the cost of capital for the economy. Long-term rates fall below where they would otherwise have been as the central bank bids for those securities in the market. The people who used to hold them now have cash, are faced with the need to put that cash to work. Unless they're prepared simply to sit on it, that is, unless the liquidity trap really is in operation for all assets at all maturities, which I don't think it has been yet, then the efforts of those people to acquire other assets brings down yields, it compresses risk spreads, and so on. And the yields that it brings down will, of course, include those on foreign assets, not just local ones. That search for yield means that financial conditions, broadly defined, ease. The cost of capital for the non-financial sector has gone down. Now, it's been noted quite frequently in the last year or two that this amounts to more risk-taking among investors. Indeed, it does. In some discussions, that seems to carry the connotation that that's not good. But actually, prompting more risk-taking is the whole point here. Assuming that we accept the notion that there is a role for stabilisation policy, I do accept that. Some people don't accept that, but if you do accept that there is a role for stabilisation policy, then when appetite for risk evaporates, policy's job is to try to restore that appetite, at least up to a point. That's my view anyway. The key question here, actually, is what kind of risk-taking are we talking about? In particular, to what extent is that lower cost of capital to the non-financial part of the economy resulting in more risk-taking in that sector, not just the financial sector? To what extent are businesses in the real economy, so-called, becoming, as a result of these monetary policies, more prepared to take a risk? A risk on a new product, a new factory, a new process, an innovation, a new market, or a new employee. For some, increased risk-taking in the financial sector is part of the process of getting more entrepreneurs in the real economy to take those risks, the kind of risks that are part and parcel of the growth dynamic in capitalism, then that's probably a trade-off worth making. On the other hand, if some years from now we look back and find that the real economy risk-taking wasn't really happening and all that we've achieved is a pickup in leverage and risk-taking in the financial sector, then we'd be disappointed. Unfortunately, I think it's very difficult at this stage to evaluate how well that trade-off is working. It's certainly clear globally that financial conditions have been extraordinarily accommodative and that the search for yield has been a pervasive force. Risk spreads are very low, overall costs of borrowing are as low as they get. Yields on all manner of assets all around the world are being bid down to very unusually low levels. As for the effects filtering out to the broader economy, I think the only assessment that's honest is that the evidence is hard to read. In the US, where QE has been arguably the most aggressive, certainly until Japan's most recent pickup in their QE, there certainly has been recovery, excuse me, though so far, as you know, only at a reasonably moderate pace. We might look at business fixed capital spending as one very high level gauge of risk-taking by the real economy. That's certainly picked up in the US, but it's hardly at strong at high levels, and it remains quite weak, actually, in several other major jurisdictions. Now, some people would take that to mean that the unconventional monetary policies haven't been that effective, and therefore that the risk trade-off isn't being struck correctly and that these policies are too risky. Others would see it as a sign that policy hasn't tried hard enough. And still others, and I'd include myself here, who remember that it always takes time for an economy to heal after a financial crisis, and that, as usual, we don't know what the counterfactual would have been. They might simply feel that it's impossible as yet to draw strong conclusions on this question. The jury's out, I think. One can't help but observe, though, that monetary policy's ability to help growth can be impaired, and by things that the central bank has no influence over. One of monetary policy's key effects is thought to come by lowering the cost of borrowing relative to the expected rate of return on real capital, the so-called Vixellian natural rate. As you all know, I'm sort of a bit Vixellian in the way I think, and I think this is a useful framework. So you've got this natural rate on the capital stock, and you've got the rate the central bank sets. If for some reason that natural rate in the real capital stock is low, then for monetary policy to impart stimulus to the economy requires very low policy rates. Perhaps the natural rate for some reason could fall so low that it becomes impossible for policy to exert much stimulus at all, because a whole range of nominal interest rates reached the zero lower bound, and that isn't low enough to get the stimulus that's needed. In extremis, a persistent case of that would, I think, amount to conditions that could be described, as Larry Summers did recently, as secular stagnation. In that sort of world, were we ever to be there, central banks can still carry out some of their critical functions. They can make portfolios more liquid. They can cut short an incipient spiral of defaults, falling asset values, contracting credit, and so on, that would otherwise be more devastating. And they can significantly lessen the burden on those who have too much debt as they seek to deleverage by having interest rates very low, admittedly at the cost of lowering the incomes of savers. But if people simply don't wish to take on new business risk, if they don't want to borrow to do that, well, monetary policy can't make them. We might be, to use another phrase from the past, pushing on a string. So what sorts of things might result in those conditions? What sort of things could we think of that could result in a very low natural rate of return on capital, and have they been in operation? Well, the Austrian tradition would point to previous overinvestment in capital, after which typically expected returns in the future are then very, very low or non-existent. And that does seem to have been part of the bubble economy story for Japan. If you look back, very high rate of fixed investment by businesses in the bubble period and then a collapse thereafter. In the more recent episode, there was clearly some overinvestment in housing in the US and one or two other countries. Spain comes to mind. But a casual look at business investment in most advanced countries, I don't think suggests, at least not obviously, that there was overinvestment there pre the crisis. Visitors to the United States, I don't think, would easily conclude that America has overinvested in infrastructure. And nor would they if they visited the UK or, frankly, if they visited Australia. What other things might be at work in lowering the rate of return on real capital? Well, we could think about a decline in the economy's potential growth rate. That could be driven by lower population growth or lower productivity growth or both. Well, in Japan, whose population is declining, this seems to me potentially quite an issue. And indeed, I think, as I've said before, that Japan's biggest problem isn't deflating prices, but problem though that be, their biggest problem has been a poor potential growth path, and most of what Abenomics is about is trying to lift that path. The dynamics of some European countries on the population side aren't much better, actually. But that's not obviously a problem for the United States, or indeed for ourselves. What about productivity? Well, if the process of innovation that's a precursor to productivity growth were to be impaired for some reason, or maybe if research and experimentation simply by random chance had fewer successes for a while, maybe that would lessen the perceived opportunities to deploy capital profitably. How do you gauge? That's very hard. One fact that seems to me relevant is that since the year 2008, the number of patents granted in the United States has risen by nearly two-thirds. That, to me, doesn't suggest that the desire to innovate has collapsed. Maybe the answer is just subdue animal spirits, another term from the long-distant past, which these days we'd call low levels of confidence. After all, the natural rate of return, maybe it's an expected concept. So if people simply expect it will be low or subject to high risk for whatever reason, they'll be reluctant to invest, even if their past returns and current returns have been good. It's conceivable, I think, that that could be a self-reinforcing low confidence equilibrium. It's very difficult to assess that. And clearly there's the potential for multiple equilibria, actually. But it does seem to me that businesses in many places are today much more conscious of risk relative to return than they were in the pre-crisis period. And I think they've been pressured in that direction by shareholders, analysts, rating agencies, and so on. Hopefully, at some point, the analysts and the investor community and the shareholders will ask fewer questions about risk reduction and more about what the company's growth strategy is, and we might get better animal spirits. But I think there has been some of that dynamic at work. So overall, there are some things you could point to here. In a few cases, it's hard to be definitive. But suppose such forces have been in operation. Then the question is, are we stuck in this low-return, pessimistic equilibrium for a long time? Or will such forces abate? And if so, when? Well, it's hard to say, of course. I would argue for realism, as opposed to either naive optimism or the rather determined pessimism that I think we very often hear. Certainly, expectations in the earlier period, pre the crisis, about risk and return were too optimistic, and we've been through a period of adjustment, and I think that had to happen. But it's doubtful, I think, that the desire to experiment and innovate has entirely disappeared. And it seems to me unduly pessimistic to think that everything that can be invented has been, or that every improvement to existing ways of doing things has already been put in place. And unless we think that the human tendency for optimism has been completely drummed out of us, which I doubt, then eventually animal spirits in the real economy surely at some point will improve. The question then is what you might do to make that happen more quickly. Well, let me say that in my opinion it is highly unlikely that the answer to that is going to come from monetary policy for the reasons I've been describing. But this is where, actually, to bring it home in our G20 chair year, this is where the G20 agenda on growth can, if it's used properly, be of considerable help. If, for example, reforms on the supply side of the G20 economies could impart a sense of dynamism and opportunity, if the governance, the risk sharing and other issues surrounding new infrastructure could be successfully tackled, unlocking the huge potential for both public and private investment in that sphere, if the efforts to complete the main financial regulatory agenda could deliver both a safer system and less uncertainty, and without unnecessarily crimping growth, so that the financial sector is actually back to a position of being able to support growth, and if free trade agreements could actually mean what their title suggests, and other things besides those, then the potential growth path of the world would look, and it would actually be, improved. Then the highly accommodative financial conditions would have a more powerful effect in engendering real growth. A rising confidence dynamic could unfold. The prospects for profitable investments by businesses would be significantly improved. And then, maybe at a future Anika Foundation lunch, we'd be able to look back and conclude that the challenges facing economic policy had been met. For now, it remains to me to thank you for your attention, for coming out today again and supporting the Foundation's work in raising awareness about adolescent depression and suicide. And on behalf of the board and all the people that we've been able to support over the years, I thank you for your generosity, and I'll attempt a few questions. Thank you.
Matthew Johnson, UBS. Governor Stevens, thank you for your very interesting speech. My question is a little closer to home. On the 7th of March, you told the House of Representatives that monetary policy was doing the things that could reasonably be expected of it. Since that time, the Australian dollar has risen substantially. So is it still the case that monetary policy is doing all that can reasonably be expected of it?
I think policy is doing the thing that low interest rates are doing, the sorts of things they normally do in most respects. I'd still maintain up to this point that we're doing what can reasonably be done, but if there's more that can reasonably be done at some point, then obviously we'd do that. But I'm content right now.
Yeah, Warren Bird, independent, semi-retired, enjoying life.
Good for you.
let's suppose that the natural rate hasn't declined long term. And that therefore, over the next few years, the Fed and eventually Europe will need to, quote-unquote, normalise interest rates. There's a lot of discussion in markets at the moment about how practically that can happen, given all the assets on their balance sheet and that sort of thing. So could you just venture a few thoughts on that particular challenge to policy implementation when it is needed?
I very much hope that we see the beginning of that normalisation, at least in the US case, within the period that it's being talked about. I think they'll be first. The technical question of can you lift the interest rates while all the cash is still in the system, at least in principle the answer to that is that you can, provided you've got the other tools to, in a sense, lock up enough of the liquidity. If you cast your mind back to, we doubled our balance sheet in post the crisis through into the early part of 2009. A lot more settlement funds went into the system, but the cash rate didn't go any lower than 3%. So we were able to manage a positive interest rate, elevated levels of ESA balances by various devices to lock them up. And I think if you look at what the Fed's been talking about with the development of the various tools, without wanting to go into detail, it seems to me that's the kind of thing they have in mind. So technically it is feasible to do that, and I think from as far as I can see, They've signalled reasonably clearly that the funds rate will, when the time is right, start to lift, and that's likely to be while the balance sheet is still quite large. And I think technically that's feasible to do.
Governor, thank you for your speech. Two points or questions from today. Obviously, as you said, QE has been variously termed as unconventional monetary policy. From your speech today, should we draw conclusions that unconventional monetary policy should be perhaps now seen as conventional monetary policy in such circumstances? And secondly, with your questioning around the return of animal spirits, to what degree do you think demographics may be playing perhaps a disproportional effect, particularly in the developed world, in terms of response to this crisis and the willingness for demand to pick up and hence to drive real investment and therefore back to some perhaps more normal levels of growth, as you might call them?
Was the first part of the question, should unconventional policies be conventional?
Should they be now seen as conventional?
Well, I kind of hope not, I guess, in the sense that I'd still maintain the hope that we don't get into the position of ever needing to use them. And I think it would be vastly preferable to get to eventually be back at the world where the central bank had a normal balance sheet and operated on the overnight rate. I think it'll be a long time before we do get back to that, though, in some of the major jurisdictions. So however one labels it, the larger balance sheets will be a feature of things for quite some time. On demographics, I'm not sure I'd say it's exerting a disproportionate influence, but I suspect over time it has been exerting a bigger influence than we had all thought about. I think when you contemplate how big these forces could turn out to be, probably the world should have been paying a little more attention to those things for longer. And I think you're right to question whether, at least in some jurisdictions, things like retirement age, benefits for the older people, health costs and so on, these are going to be very, very difficult problems to deal with from a public finance point of view. All the more reason that it's good to start early.
Rory Robertson, Westpac Treasury. Governor, you mentioned Ben Bernanke. I've got a theory that the smartest thing that George W. Bush ever did was appoint Ben Bernanke to be chairman of the Fed in advance of the global economic crisis. In the Australian context, I've got a theory that one of the smartest things that Treasurer Costello ever did was appoint you to the governorship of the Reserve Bank. Seriously, before the darkest days of 2008 and 2009, when the Australian economy, the Australian institutions, Australian markets were subjected to the most profound stress test they've ever been, in decades, and we came through with flying colours, in part because of the performance of the Reserve Bank and the Treasury and the other institutions. So I'm thinking now we've seen the announced removal of a well-performed Treasury Secretary, and sometimes in Canberra it looks a bit like a political circus. I'd like to say I find great comfort in the fact that the Reserve Bank is there providing the steady hand. And so I don't have a question.
I don't have an answer either.
But I do have a statement. I'm not the right person to do this, but it is the right audience. I'd like to congratulate you and thank you on behalf of this audience for your efforts and your team's efforts in those darkest days back in 2008, 2009, because I think at that point it mattered who was in charge, and I'd just like to thank you for those efforts, sir. Oh.
Thank you.
Governor, it's Sue Lannan from the PM program on ABC Radio. How much of an impact do you think geopolitics, particularly the crisis in Ukraine and the war in Gaza, is having on financial markets?
I think that remains to be seen. right now, I think, and we've said this, and everyone here knows this, markets, for the most part, have been remarkably sanguine about a whole range of things lately. Volatility is exceptionally low. Risk spreads are highly compressed. Markets, it would appear, in the actual pricing, are giving pretty low weight to the possibility that something will go wrong. But I think that's a feature right now. So, but as for Ukraine and Gaza and any number of other things, well, I guess we have to watch this space.
Matt Sherwood, Perpetual Investments, Governor. Looking at the 2009 crisis, it was a problems in balance sheets in three sectors: the government, the household sector, and the banking sector. And the key there was actually getting the balance sheets fixed in the right order. The US fixed first the bank balance sheet through equity injection, then the households through low interest rates and QE, and now they're going to fix the government balance sheet through growth. When we look at the other side of the Atlantic, Europe's tried to fix the government balance sheet first through austerity. They don't really have a plan for fixing the households and the bank balance sheets other than through low interest rates. So would you think their policy process, in light of that, has made their situation more difficult to solve?
Well, I'm not sure that you can generalise about European households. Some of them have a lot of debt, but some don't. So that's a bit different. And I think the most difficult problem that the Europeans faced was the kind of feedback loop between the bank balance sheets and the sovereign balance sheets, particularly the peripheral ones. And, you know, that's kind of an order of magnitude more difficult than the problems the US faced, I think, notwithstanding that the US faced very difficult problems. So I guess I'm not inclined to give lectures about budgetary policy, even here, let alone to other countries. As I said in the talk, though, I think the fact that many governments had really not been doing the things they should have been doing on the fiscal side for a long time and found themselves already carrying quite a bit of debt, then suddenly you've got a deep downturn, you might have to fix up a bank, now you've got a potentially serious debt issue, and then you have a confidence dynamic where people think this is unsustainable, so the rate rises, and then it is. Right now, of course, that's gone the other way. For some reason, it's sustainable, the interest rates have come way down, and so it is sustainable. So you can get these multiple equilibria, which I think makes it very difficult to deal with, but long-standing, I think, reluctance to address the fiscal issues in some countries in Europe, not all. You know, Spain went into this with actually a fairly low debt-to-GDP ratio by most standards. It ain't low anymore because the crisis was big enough to make the difference. So it's harder to generalise, but I think there is this difficulty, and it harks back to a question someone asked earlier. As you get demographics and ageing and entitlements, it's very hard for the political process to kind of contain that. And that's part of why I think some of the Europeans have ended up in a situation where the fiscal accounts are fragile.
Glenn, Paul Brennan from Citi. Listening through your speech, I think you mentioned at least three factors that could be behind the expected low returns. So just going through those, there was population, demographics, and I think the third one was animal spirits. So just thinking through that checklist, if you like, for Australia, we're probably doing pretty well on all three, even on animal spirits. Business confidence, for example, is pretty reasonable, but consumer confidence, I guess, is missing. But my question is, to what extent is there anything further, if Australia's doing reasonably well on those three criteria, is there anything materially further we can do in that regard? Or is it more a function of us waiting for the world to sort of address those three criteria?
I guess I'd agree mostly with the premise of the question that declining population, that's not a problem for us. As people would know, I've been a little bit optimistic on the productivity side. We had a disappointing period, but I think that has been improving. There's no doubt more we can do there. Get the list, as I've said before. Get the Gary Banks list. Animal spirits. My sense is that in a lot of areas of business, people are sitting around tables saying, yeah, somebody needs to do something and we're waiting for someone else to do it. And, you know, start the investment and think about growth for the future. But, you know, if we all wait for someone else to do it, no one does it. So I guess my message is over to you guys. I think, you know, we could have a little bit of confidence in ourselves in the long run, and that might do us a power of good.
Jonathan Merlis Black from Rare Infrastructure. I think a number of us will be very pleased to see some of the policy initiatives coming out of Australia's leadership of the G20 process this year. Just with respect to our first speaker, how do we make sure that we don't fall into the trap of Australia writing very good policies which aren't then implemented?
Fair question, and you don't make it better by not starting with good policy, so we should do that. And implementation of these things requires commitment of the necessary resources and the preparedness to do post-implementation reviews and amend course if things are not turning out as they should. And I think it's a fair point to say more focus on implementation and maybe a little less focus on the soundbite announcement and then thinking that's it. That isn't it. That's the beginning. And the implementation matters.
We're giving one more?
Sure.
Okay, we'll do the last question.
Jacob Grieber.
Jacob Grieber from the Financial Review. I think in your forecasts, you tend, when it comes to fiscal policy, to build in what has actually passed Parliament. When it comes to budgets, we've had a pretty tumultuous few weeks. A certain number of things haven't made it through. What's your assessment now about how contractionary this budget is, perhaps in the short term, and also obviously going out, and also to what extent that is playing on this problem with our animal spirits?
I never felt that the budget per se was especially contractionary in the short term, and I've said that. It wasn't view-changing relative to what we had already been assuming, and I think that was clear in the previous address I gave in Hobart. What's going to emerge from this process? Well, I don't know any more than you. We can only wait to see. As far as confidence goes, one or two people have already referred to decline in measures of consumer confidence, and that's obviously true. It remains to be seen whether that recovers, as it has on some other occasions where we've had budgets with tough messages. To my eye, there hasn't really been any effect in indexes of business confidence since the budget, though, if anything, probably gone up a little. So nothing much to speak of there. The key question might ultimately be, really, whether the current processes can result in collective confidence in the country that we can actually grapple with difficult issues, long-term issues, have a sensible conversation, and come up with some solutions. That, I mean, if we can do that, that actually would be good for our confidence. If we can't, well, obviously, that won't help.